I'm James Myers, host of Plato's Pod, and in this episode, Michael Fitzpatrick and I continue our discussion on Plato's letters. This time, our focus is on his lesser-known letters 6 and 8, which, like letter 7 that we reviewed in our previous two episodes, both address the place of philosophy and politics from Plato's personal experience. Together with letter 7, letters 6 and 8 offer a very timely and valuable perspective on problems with justice, tyranny, and autocracy that continue to plague the world 2,400 years after Plato's writing, and Michael and I address a number of these modern connections in our discussion. Like the famous 7th letter, letters 6 and 8 highlight the benefits of friendly relations between rulers and the ruled, and in letter 8 we see Plato laying out the basis for government by a king that's very different from the way kings have traditionally ruled for thousands of years right up to today. A good king, he says, doesn't exercise arbitrary and oppressive power, but instead is a servant of the laws and of justice even more so than the people he governs. In the Republic, Plato warned how democracies, like his Athens, can dissolve into tyranny and injustice of the type that put Socrates to death. In today's world, when democracies are again giving way to authoritarianism and tyranny, a virtuous king ruling virtuous citizens in a social harmony is a political model that we might consider. I hope you enjoy this discussion as much as I did. And as always, we'd love to hear your comments and suggestions for Plato's Pod. Please contact us at dialoguesonplato@outlook.com to share your thoughts. And now, with thanks for sharing your time with us, here's our discussion on Plato's 6th and 8th letters. Well, Michael, welcome back, and I'm really looking forward today to discussing Plato's letters 6 and 8 after some great discussions we had on letter 7. So I thought we'd just give it a bit of introduction here. I know we spoke about the authenticity of Plato's letters, and I think we both concluded letter 7 was pretty much in the voice of Plato. And I find letters 6 and 8 to be pretty similar. And, you know, letter 6 is very short, and we'll read practically the whole thing today. Letter 8, I find Plato's voice in that too. If you could just talk a little bit about the context of the authenticity of letters 6 and 8 that we'll be discussing today. And also, letter 6 is written by Plato to Hermias and Erastus and Coriscus. So these are three different characters. Hermias was a tyrant, and Erastus and Coriscus were members of the Academy. And maybe if you could give us just a little bit of background on that before I go ahead and read letter 6.
Thank you, James. I'm very happy to give some context here because, you know, letter 7 is famous and widely read. Most of the other letters that are attributed to Plato never get airtime. So I hope listeners realize what a privilege it is to get to hear some of these other letters. I consider letter 6 and letter 8 the next two most likely to be authentic to the hand of Plato. And one of the reasons for this is like what we discussed last time, which is both letters discuss intimate details of Plato's personal life. And, you know, unless there's a doppelganger running around Athens who had a perfect photographic memory of how Plato thought and lived, the simplest explanation is that Plato himself wrote these letters. And we can see a little bit of that in letter 6. Because of the people to whom this letter is addressed. So as you mentioned, we have three characters here, and Erastus and Coriscus, we do know of slightly from some other historical sources that also attest they were students in Plato's Academy. But really, this letter is one of the best sources of information that we have about them. So it's either written by Plato or somebody who was intimately acquainted with Plato and these two people. But the other thing that might surprise some listeners is that Hermias, who is the central third character here, was also a close acquaintance of Plato. And it's possible that he also was a student of Plato's. We don't know for sure. But he definitely associated with both Plato and later Aristotle and engaged with a lot of ideas and dialogues with both of them. So Hermias ruled the Ionian city of Artaneus in the mid 4th century BC. And he actually came to his power later in life after he had associated with Plato and had a chance to learn some of Plato's idea. He actually inherited the rule of Artanias, and this was around 351 BC. And a lot of what is happening in this letter is Plato trying to give this person who has gained an enormous amount of power the benefit of surrounding himself with the kinds of advisors who will lead to what Plato will sometimes call a kingship rather than a tyranny. I don't know if he uses that language in this letter, but he will in letter eight. And if listeners don't remember that distinction from Plato, it's a difference between somebody who rules for the benefit of themselves versus somebody who rules for the benefit of the common good. So don't think of a king the way modern people do, where it's just a monarchy who can do whatever they want. No, a king for Plato is somebody who rules with virtue. And letter eight, we should think of as a kind of sequel to letter seven. It's written where events after Dion's death have progressed a little more time has gone by. And again, some people who are from that circle who live in Syracuse have reached out to Plato and said, hey, we really need help on figuring out how to move forward. So I think the best way for listeners to think about our conversation here is we're again getting a lens into the practical Plato. Both of these letters are about how to put into practice the kinds of ideas that he and his students would discuss in the academy. And to just read one little excerpt, I think this will come in perhaps in what you're about to read, but I just want to highlight this so everyone's paying attention to it. At the very beginning of letter six, he says, "And to Erastus and Corsicus, I say, old as I am, that they need to supplement their knowledge of the ideas, that noble doctrine, with the knowledge and capacity to protect themselves against wicked and unjust men." And I love that line because the knowledge of the doctrine of ideas, that's Plato's great philosophy. But he's saying that's no good if you don't know how to manage the political situation where people are engaging in treachery, there's palace intrigue, conspiracies are abounding. If you're not gaining that practical knowledge to go with it, you're not going to be able to hold power or to advise power long enough for it to be effective.
That's really helpful, thank you. And I think, I get the sense, as I think we'll see maybe when I read letter six momentarily, that it seems that Hermias is a perhaps more sympathetic character than Dionysius, who was the main character that was talked about in letter seven, the tyrant in letter seven, the ruler of Syracuse. So here I think we have maybe a different type of person that Plato is engaging here with, as you mentioned, the two students of the academy. So let me start by reading letter six, and this is practically the entire letter. "It is evident to me that some god has graciously and generously prepared good luck for you, if you receive his gift properly. For you are living as neighbors to one another, and each of you needs what the others can best supply. Hermias should know that his power, for all purposes, has its greatest support not in the number of his horses or other equipment of war, nor in the gold he adds to his treasury, but in the steadfast friends of solid character. And to Erastus and Coriscus, I say, old as I am, that they need to supplement their knowledge of the ideas, that noble doctrine, with the knowledge and capacity to protect themselves against wicked and unjust men. They are inexperienced. Since they have spent a great part of their lives with us, among men of moderation and goodwill, this is why I said they need some power to protect them, that they may not be forced to neglect the true wisdom and concern themselves more than is fitting with that which is worldly and necessary. Now, this power that they need, Hermias apparently possesses, both as a natural gift, so far as one may judge without knowing him, and as an art perfected by experience. What is the point of these remarks? To you, Hermias, since I have known Erastus and Coriscus longer than you have, I solemnly declare and bear witness that you will not easily find more trustworthy characters than these neighbors of yours. And I therefore advise you to make it a matter of central importance to attach yourself to them by every honorable means. Coriscus and Erastus, in their turn, I advise to hold fast to Hermias, and to try to develop his mutual alliance into a bond of friendship. If ever any one of you should seem to be weakening this union, for nothing human is altogether secure, send a letter to me and my friends declaring the grievance. For unless the injury be very grave, I believe your sense of justice and your respect for us will make the words that we may send more efficacious than any incantation would be in binding up the wound and causing you to grow together again into friendship and fellowship as before. If all of us, you and we alike, according to our several abilities and opportunities, apply our wisdom to the preservation of this bond, the prophecies I have just uttered will come true. What will happen if we do not, I will not say, for I am prophesying only what is good, and I declare that with God's help, we shall bring all these things to a good issue. Let this letter be read, if possible, by all three of you gathered together, otherwise by twos, and as often as you can in common. Adopt it as a just and binding law and covenant, taking a solemn oath, in gentlemanly earnest, but with the playfulness that is the sister of solemnity, in the name of the divine letter of all things present and to come, and in the name of the lordly father of this governor and cause, whom we shall all some day clearly know, in so far as the blessed are able to know him, if we truly live the life of philosophy. Well, that is essentially letter six. And as you mentioned, Michael, that the call for the members of the academy to kind of descend from this realm of ideas and to understand how it works in practice, I think, is a really interesting thing. And again, I think very much in keeping with the purpose of the seventh letter that we discussed, the idea of the philosopher actually being practical and understanding how the world works. He makes that comment in here that nothing human is altogether secure. And I think that's something we all experience in our own lives. And maybe that's the beauty, but also the challenge of being human. So, what are your thoughts on letter six?
Well, I'm glad you highlighted that parenthetical comment that nothing human is altogether secure, because that's another witness that Plato is not a utopian. He doesn't think we're gonna solve political problems for all time and we'll be singing kumbaya into eternity. But I want to start kind of with the end of this letter, because he gives them an instruction to read the letter together. And by read here, he means to read it aloud. So this is like it's kind of like a scripture reading almost, a communal. We're going to come together to read the wise words of Plato. And he says to adopt it as a just and binding law and covenant, taking a solemn oath. So this is a ritual that is supposed to bind Hermias, Corsicus, and Orestes to each other as living for this higher bond, guided by the form of the good, so as to guard against the dissolution that comes from mistrust and palace intrigue and greed and so forth. And then the last part of this, I think, is just so fascinating. He says that this oath is supposed to have both earnestness, so you have to mean what you say, and playfulness, which he says is the sister of solemnity. And you and I have pointed out many times the humor and mirth that's in Plato's writings. And here, he's either 70 or approaching 70 as he writes this, so he's an older man, but he still very much believes that part of the recipe for true friendship is not just sincerity, but also joy, that you have to enjoy being together, serving one another, uplifting one another, defending one another, and so on.
That's a great point to recall. It reminds me of the symposium, the tremendously funny, humorous part when Alcibiades comes in incredibly drunk. And we listen to this and we understand that philosophy is not just something that's dull, but it's something that can be fun. And I find, especially here, too, the appeal to friendship is very interesting. So Hermias, I guess, is the one who would naturally be inclined not to engage in friendship because he has all the power. Why does a powerful person need to engage in friendship? And I think we see such powerful people in the world today who like to lord it over other people with their power, and in the course of doing so, clearly and publicly destroy some very important friendships. And for the moment, it might seem that that adds to a person's power, but I guess when one is isolated, when a powerful leader is isolated, the power tends to dissolve. And when the leader's left all alone with no friends, that's when things become, I think, very, very dangerous for such leaders and very dangerous for their people as well. And I think this idea of friendship among the people and their rulers, I think, is important. And I think we saw that in Plato's Laws when we talked about the laws, the idea of both the citizens and the leaders being virtuous. And I think, as you mentioned, with the role of the kings, which we'll see in letter eight, that the king is not somebody who is just, dictatorial and just does things for his own pleasure, such as if we think of a king like that, Henry VIII maybe comes to mind, who just, does what he wants. He's not constrained by anything. But as you mentioned, Plato is not talking about that kind of king. And I don't think he's appealing to, I think he's appealing to Hermias not to be that type of ruler, but a type of ruler that understands the power of friendship.
Yeah, there's an interesting way in which the friendship that's being proposed here is an exchange of goods, but it's not transactional. What Plato is proposing here is not, oh, Hermias should give Erastus and Corsicus something, and then they'll give him something in return, and that's the only reason for doing it. No, the exchange here is the good of each other's souls. So he says that Erastus and Corsicus have this knowledge of ideas, but they don't understand how to apply these ideas in a way that is fitting to the world as they find it. And he says this power that they need, Hermias apparently possesses, both as natural gift and as an art perfected by experience. So Hermias is in a kingship and has applied this art of rule for some period of time, and so is the perfect opportunity for these young philosophers to apply their talents in a real context. And so it's about, like you said, leaving the sunshine, going back down to the cave, which for Plato is part of the maturation of the philosophical soul. But on the flip side, Hermias is only going to evolve towards being a king rather than a tyrant if he surrounds himself with trustworthy characters who act from honorable intentions and using honorable means. And so this is part of Plato's vision that you're only going to have just rulers if they are themselves just, and that they have just friends. And the reason why that second part's so important is it's really hard to maintain a just character if you're doing it by yourself and everyone around you is corrupt. And so it's much better to be a person of just character and to surround yourself with just friends. Or, as probably is the case here, if Hermias is not yet a leader of just character, the best way to get there is to surround himself with people who can model that and advise him accordingly so that he can learn and grow in his own soul.
Yeah, and I think, especially at the end where he says, if we truly live the life of philosophy, we'll know the eternal, but we'll never reach that point unless we truly know the life of philosophy, philosophy meaning love of wisdom. And he appeals to Hermias to protect, as you said, it's not just protecting individuals, it's protecting their souls, protecting their ability to continue as philosophers, but to continue as philosophers in a practical setting. And I think that's the key thing, that where in letter seven, Dionysius was wedded to this idea of factionalism and mistrust and really manipulating people, not protecting them, but manipulating them. And that's all Dionysius knew how to do. And he refused to learn any other method of operating. Here, I think Plato is calling on Hermias to be quite different and to protect, but not transactional, as you said. He's not going to get anything material back. He's going to get philosophy back. And that's the value. And again, we see transactional rulers in the world today who want a tit for tat sort of arrangement. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. It's not about friendship. It's about who gets the most, who gets, how we balance our benefits of this relationship. The benefit of this relationship here that Plato is talking about is more a metaphysical benefit, I guess, to benefit really the souls of all three of them.
Yeah, wonderful. I love the line towards the end of that second big paragraph you read, where Plato says, what will happen if we do not pursue these bonds of friendship? I will not say, for I am prophesying only what is good. And I declare that with God's help, we shall bring all these things to a good issue. So, I mean, that's in some ways what the role of a philosophical teacher is, to prophesy what is good. So they're not saying, I can tell you how the world is going to unfold. We'll see this more in letter eight, that Plato is very comfortable with the role of time and chance and how things unfold. There are always going to be factors we didn't take into account or things we didn't know. But he's saying that that has to do with the realm of becoming. And the philosopher has attended to the realm of being, that which always is. And so, regardless of what happens in the realm of becoming, the philosopher can always prophesy as to what is good, because that doesn't change with the circumstances, even if how to apply the good, which is the practical part, does evolve depending on the circumstances. But what is good does not evolve. So, he's saying the need for a philosophical friendship. That will always be the case, whatever the circumstances happen to be. But what holds that together is going to depend on your commitment to these bonds in this particular context.
Yeah, I love that distinction again between the eternal, changeless, timeless realm of being, which is accessible by the mind but not the body, accessible by reason, not by empirical evidence. That's the permanent realm which the philosopher is reaching up to, but we live in this constantly changing realm of becoming, and that's the realm where it's difficult and nothing is ever stable. So yeah, it's a balancing act. Between being and becoming, really, I guess it's a balancing act. Well, that's great to say. I mean, letter six, I find is a very kind of uplifting letter. It's an appeal to people of very different backgrounds to come together. You know, some very positive advice here, and one can imagine, hopefully, the three of them sitting down, reading that letter, and continuously reminding themselves of what their role is. So that's good. Shall we move to letter eight then?
Okay, we're going to turn to letter eight now. And I just want to emphasize this is written to the friends of Dion, which means not just people that he was affectionate with, but political allies, comrades, anyone who was trying to help him work for a free and just Sicily. And this letter comes after a little more time has elapsed since the discussion that took place in letter seven. I'm going to read 352D to 353E, which opens the letter. Since the fall of the tyranny, you have had nothing but dissension throughout all Sicily, one party desiring to get its power back, the other to make final the suppression of the tyranny. In such circumstances, the multitude always think the right counsel is to recommend those measures that will do their enemies the most harm and their friends the most good. But it is by no means easy to do great harm to others without bringing many other evils upon oneself. We have a clear example of this close at hand. Only look at what has happened right here in Sicily, with one party attempting to act upon that principle and the other defending itself against their actions. The story of these events, if you should tell it to others, would give them many useful lessons, though of such instruction there is hardly any need. On the other hand, a policy that would benefit all concerned, friends and foes alike, or do as little harm as possible to both, this is not easy to see, nor to carry out when it is seen. And to counsel such a policy, or attempt to explain it, seems like making a prayer. By all means, let it be a prayer, for the gods should be first in every man's words and thoughts. And may it be fulfilled when it declares unto us some such word as follows. Now you and your enemies have been ruled almost continuously from the beginning of the war by a single family, A family that your ancestors put in power at a time when they were in the direst peril, and there was imminent danger that all of Hellenic Sicily would be overrun by the Carthaginians and become barbarian territory. For then it was that to save Sicily, they chose Dionysius, a young and brilliant warrior, to take charge of the military actions for which he had an aptitude, and Hipparinus as his elder and counselor, making them, as they say, generals with full power. Was it God and divine chance that saved the city, or the valor of these leaders, or both luck and leadership together with the efforts of the citizens? Think what you will. In any case, the city was saved for that generation. It is right that everyone should feel gratitude to these saviors for the qualities they displayed. And if in later times the tyrants misused in any way the gift the city had bestowed upon them, for these misdeeds they have in part paid the penalty and even further atonement. But what penalties would it necessarily be right to impose in the present state of their affairs? If you were able to get rid of them easily and without great toil and danger, or if they could easily regain their power, there would be no occasion for offering the advice that I'm going to give. As it is, however, both of your factions ought to reflect and call to mind how often each party has been in high hopes, and has thought almost always that it lacked only a little of being able to do what it liked, and that this little has repeatedly turned out to be the cause of great and innumerable disasters. The limit is never reached, but what seems to be the end of an old difficulty always involves the beginning of a new one. And in this endless round, there is danger that both the tyrannical party and the democratic party will be completely destroyed. And eventually, if things take their natural course, which God forbid, the whole of Sicily will have practically lost the Greek language and will have come under the empire and domination of the Phoenicians or the OPC.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, that the ending of that, I think, is it's such an observation on things as they exist even today. I mean, 2,400 years later, this thinking that if we just win a little bit more, we can settle all of these things, but there's always this chain reaction. I think, as he says, we think that it lacked only a little of being able to do what it liked, but this has repeatedly turned out to be the cause of a great and innumerable disasters. The limit is never reached. I love that line. And it leads to an endless round of tyranny and democracy sort of butting heads, I guess. And this is what we see today. I think it's still present. So it's an observation, I think, on human behavior, just human desires. And again, that recalling sort of in the middle, I guess. He says, was it both luck and leadership together with the efforts of the citizens that saved the city? So again, that reminder of friendship as being important. It's not just power alone that can save the city, but it's friendship, I think, that needs it. And the part about luck, again, nothing in human affairs is secure, as he said in letter six. One has to be prepared for chance. And be ready for that and understand that chance operates and that nothing operates entirely under one's control, even if one is a powerful tyrant. He says it's not easy to see, but we have to realize that we do these things for the long term, not for short-term results that we can see. The long-term part is hard to see.
Yeah, that's really crucial to understand. In case listeners didn't catch it, there's a contrast that's sort of happening in this first section. The contrast is between the competition of factions, where the goal is for one faction to win out and then impose their will, as you say, to the limit. And the thing that he's contrasting, which is what Plato is actually advocating for, is, and I'll read the passage again, a policy that would benefit all concerned, friends and foes alike. That's the shorthand version of that he gives in the laws is acting for the common good. So this cycle that you're talking about, the problem with it is that if you're only ever trying to achieve the gains of your faction, then you're always creating a situation where there's somebody that's left outside of the benefits or whatever those gains are. And that someone is going to form a reactionary force that's then going to push back against what you're doing and perpetuate this cycle. And I actually think we see this in the partisanship of modern day democracies, both presidential and parliamentary systems. In the United States, because it's a presidential system, it's sort of evolved into a two-party system. So it doesn't really matter what the parties stand for because they're always going to oppose whatever the other party is doing. And in parliamentary governments, we see something similar where even though there's more parties that are permitted, they still tend to organize themselves into the governing coalition and the opposition coalition. And so you do end up with a binary struggle where whoever's not in power is just biding their time until they can get into power and reverse everything that the other party did. And as you said, that destroys long-term thinking because it means every 4, 8, 12 years, all the policies and direction of the country is getting shifted in an opposite direction. So if you think about a problem like climate change, which requires multi-decade, multinational coordination, it's been really difficult for the nations of the world to work towards good climate policy because that requires a sustained common aim over many decades. And if governments are constantly reversing themselves, it's very hard to achieve that.
A really good observation. And, in fact, in our parliament here in Canada, the party with the most members of parliament is typically in government, but the party with the second most members is the opposition. And the leader of that party is called the leader of the opposition. And it's really kind of become where that leader is becomes almost incapable. And this is not just the current leader of the opposition, but historically, the leader of the opposition sees it as a loss if he or she were to agree to anything that the government does, and that becomes just a permanent opposition. So even if the government did something good, they see it as their role to just simply oppose and not to necessarily present viable alternatives with the long run, a long-term benefit, such as climate change, which is a great thing to bring up. I think the problem with retribution for powerful leaders who seek retribution is that that will always engender enemies. And while your enemies might not be currently powerful, you might be incredibly powerful with the greatest military under your thumb, but eventually enough people suffering retribution will gather up against you. And this is the lesson of history, I think. History shows that no empire has ever lasted, and empires fall either because other empires with greater military might come about, but empires fall because of dissension, internal dissension. And I think the Roman Empire was a good example of that. So I think there's a few leaders on Earth now with very powerful militaries who are actively engaged in trying to create empires. I think it would be good, and I've talked before about history, we should learn history. I think it would be good if they look back at history and really understood what makes empires fall. And if they understood the problems of going out seeking retribution all the time, maybe they would be inclined to think a little bit more long term. So I know you've written in Plato for the Masses on your Substack about the party system capturing government. And we see this in Canada, we see this in other nations where it just becomes almost tribal contest, as opposed to what's really good for the people. No, it becomes more what's good for this particular tribe of political opinion versus that particular tribe. So, yeah, a good observation.
And we also should notice here some connections to the Platonic dialogues that are relevant to what you just said. At the very beginning, he has this remark that the factions are trying to do their enemies the most harm and their friends the most good. Of course, that was one of the early conceptions of justice that show up in the Republic. And so we can see why Plato is so skeptical of that when he's writing the Republic, because it leads to this cycle of retribution that you just described. But the other thing that I noticed in this section is this historical story that he tells about how Dionysius came to power. I assume that he's talking about Dionysius Senior, the father, that they were fearful of the Carthaginians overrunning Sicily and making it a vassal state of their empire. And so they empowered Dionysius and one of his advisors to be generals with unlimited power in order to save the state. And this is kind of the situation that he describes in Book 8 of the Republic about how a democracy goes to a tyranny, is that at some point the people think, oh, we've got to have a warrior who's going to rise up and fight for us. And it's so interesting that here we see that that has led to the dissolution of Sicily. And you just mentioned, hundreds of years later, Rome is going to do the same thing where they raise up an emperor to save the empire, who then never gives the power back, becomes the Caesar. And that leads centuries later to the dissolution of Rome. We saw that with Hitler's Germany, same kind of thing. The people gave in to the demagogue who's going to save us from our woes. And we see people being tempted by that today. And so there is a pattern to history that is vindicating the type of conceptual story that Plato is telling in Book 8 of the Republic. So again, this reminds us that even though he's doing that theoretical work, it's because he has attended to the historical lessons, and it's through that lens that he's seeing why these things come about.
Yeah, and Carthage is a good example because the Romans completely wiped it out, just obliterated Carthage. And Carthage was a huge power, a huge empire. So empires come and go. And so while Rome reigned over Carthage and sought all sorts of retribution against Carthage, Rome at the end suffered kind of the same fate in different circumstances, but was eliminated. So it's something that I think the historical record is very important to leaders who go out seeking power, and leaders who seek absolute power really should understand the pitfalls of what they're doing before they go out and think that they alone over any ruler in history will succeed where none others succeeded. As Plato says, the limit is never reached.
Yeah, the fantasy that, again, if you gave us just a little bit more power, we'll make all your hopes and dreams come true. That is absolutely the mantra of every political party in the West today. Just vote all of us into office, give us an unlimited mandate, and watch us go. And there are very few cases where that has not led to corruption, abuses of power, dissension in the society, and almost inevitably they end up getting thrown out of power pretty soundly, or it becomes a kind of tyrannical society where they make sure they're not allowed to get thrown out of power.
And people will always come back to the question of justice. If we feel that something unjust has been done to us, we will eventually get enough power to try to correct that injustice. And I think that obviously was a central question of the Republic. And it began, as you mentioned, with the character Thrasymachus saying that justice is whatever the powerful can do. And that's clearly not the case. Again, the historical record says that's not the case. Yeah, I think some very good lessons here.
One last quick observation before we move to the next passage. He ended that first paragraph by talking about how the ideal almost feels like making a prayer. And he's this beautiful poetic way of alluding to the apparent impossibility of the ideal. And this is something that we'll talk about in future episodes when we talk about some Neoplatonic thought, that impossibility is a it's a conception of the cave. So the puppeteers who are casting shadows on the wall, it's in their best interest to ensure that the people distracted by the shadows believe that any alternative to the shadows is impossible. It's a form of control, thought control, essentially. And so Plato is here acknowledging that the ideal, from the standpoint of the situation, seems impossible. His reaction is, by all means, then let it be a prayer, and may it be fulfilled when it declares unto us some such word as follows. So what he's saying is, okay, I'm acknowledging that this seems like beyond the realm of possibility. Let's make our prayer, meaning let's insist on the ideal and work towards making the impossible possible, which throughout history in different revolutionary movements and so forth has been part of their battle cry. We're demanding the impossible. We're demanding what the ruling elites of the situation have told us could not happen. That's what we're going to demand.
Yeah, I like that. And that's one area where I hear the voice of Plato coming through in this dialogue. I think that's it's important. I love the way that you tied that to the images on the cave wall, and the fact that when we try to suppress the other possibilities, that's where justice gets lost, and we have to be able to see and imagine better things. But that involves, as you said, we can't be certain about it. We have to put some faith, or make a prayer that things will turn out with justice behind us, I think is the key thing.
Well, we're taking a risk, acknowledging the uncertainty of the future. We can't predict the future, but we're also recognizing the worthiness of the risk, because if we do nothing, then nothing will change. So we have to take that risk and hope in the prayer.
Yeah, and the risk of doing nothing, the risk of descending into that cycle of factionalism and retribution, that risk is much greater. Again, the historical record shows that. Yeah, very good point. So let me go on and continue on the reading of letter eight. So this is from 345b to 355e. What now appears best to me, I will try to explain in all frankness and set it forth with just an impartial reasoning. I am speaking in the fashion of an arbitrator between two parties at law, the one a former tyrant, the other his former subject, and proffering to each of them my well-known counsel. Now, as always, I advise the tyrant to shun his name and the reality it stands for, and to change his government to a kingship if he can. That he can is shown by the action of that wise and good man Lycurgus, who, seeing that his own relatives in Argos and Messene were becoming tyrants instead of kings, and in both cases destroying both themselves and their cities, was filled with apprehension both for his house and his native city, and instituted as a remedy the office of the elders and that of the ephors as the saving bond of the kingly power. By such means, this kingship has been signally secure through all these generations, since law became the lord and king of men, not men tyrants over the laws. Now, this is the point of my present recommendation to you all. Let those who are aiming at tyrannical power shun and flee from what senseless and insatiate men call happiness. Let them try to change into the form of kings and subject themselves to kingly laws, thus acquiring the highest honors from their willing subjects and from the laws. Likewise, I advise those who cherish the ways of freedom and shun the yoke of slavery as something evil to beware lest by an excessive and ill-timed thirst for freedom they fall into the affliction of their ancestors, the excessive anarchy they experienced as a result of their unmeasured passion for liberty. For the Sicilians before the reign of Dionysius and Hipparinus lived happily, as they thought, faring sumptuously and ruling their rulers. They it was who, without any legal judgment, stoned to death the 10 generals who preceded Dionysius, in order not to be subject to any master, not even justice and the law, but to be altogether and absolutely free. This is why tyranny came upon them. Both servitude in excess and liberty in excess are very great evils, but in due measure both are great goods. Due measure is found in obedience to God, the absence of measure in obedience to men. And the God of wise men is the law. Of foolish men, pleasure. Since this is so, I call upon the friends of Dion to say to all Syracusans that what I advise is his and my joint counsel. I shall be the interpreter of what he would say if he were alive and able to speak to you now. Well, then, someone may say, what words does Dion's counsel contain for us about our present situation? These. And here he goes on to now speak in the words of Dion. First of all, men of Syracuse, accept laws that you think will not arouse your desires and turn your thoughts toward money-making and wealth. Of the three goods, soul, body, and wealth, your laws must give the highest honor to the excellence of the soul, the second place to that of the body, as subordinate to the excellence of the soul, and the third and lowest rank to wealth, since it serves both body and soul. The sacred tradition that ranks them in this order might rightly be made a positive law among you, since it makes truly happy those who live by it, whereas the doctrine that the rich are the happy ones is a foolish saying of women and children, a miserable doctrine in itself, bringing misery upon all who follow it. Put to trial these words about law, and you will see by the event that my advice is sound. Experience seems to be the truest test of any matter. Having received laws of this sort, then, Sicily is in grave danger, and neither you nor your adversaries are clearly superior in force. It would be without question be just and expedient for all of you to strike a compromise, both for those of you who wish to avoid the rigor of absolute rule and for those who are bent on regaining their power. It was their ancestors, remember, who in their time saved the Hellenes from the barbarians and made it possible for us now to be discussing a constitution. For if the Greeks had been defeated then, there would be no opportunity for deliberation, nor any basis for hope. So now let the one party have the freedom they desire, but under the government of a king, and let the other have their office, but let it be a responsible kingship, the laws punishing kings and citizens alike if they disobey. So we'll stop there and get your thoughts. This is a very rich section. And again, I find it speaks so much to present thoughts, especially about liberty. Your thoughts?
Well, the first thing we would be remiss not to acknowledge is you and I recently completed a long series on Plato's Laws. And this first section, where he's speaking in the words of Dion, are very close to a couple passages that we get from the Laws about the order of the goods, that the most important thing is your soul, then second the body, and then lastly wealth. And this is that well-known Platonic idea that wealth has no intrinsic value. It's there to meet the material needs of the body. And then it's not that Plato is anti-body. This is one of the big misconceptions of a lot of interpreters of Plato. It's that the body exists to serve the soul. So a healthy body is very important to Plato, but it's not about satisfying the pleasures of the body or the desires of the body. It's about cultivating your body to magnify your soul, to help you become a good and righteous soul. So I really think that's an important thing to sort of connect with some of the earlier episodes and discussions on Plato's Pod. And just to catch this in case any listeners were offended by the foolish saying, he says that the idea that the rich are the people who achieve happiness, this is a foolish saying of women and children. This is actually a well-known idiom from the time of Greece, so it's not directly casting us some kind of sexist aspersion on women and children. The idiom comes from a commonplace in Greek culture that gossip was the province of those who didn't have a work to apply themselves to, and since women were oftentimes disenfranchised from the work culture and children were not yet old enough to join the work culture, there was this sort of assumption that they're the ones that all they do is sit around and gossip. So that's where that comes from. And I just want to remind listeners that in Plato's vision of the just society, everybody participates in the life of the good, men, women, and children alike.
Very good point. And I would remind listeners too, especially those who listen to the laws, that in a number of places in the laws, Plato is very specific, or at least in the voice of the Athenian, very specific, that women should be treated as equals. And I think this is very different, maybe, from a lot of other philosophers and people at the time who thought that women should be subservient. So this is clearly not Yes, it's clearly not an aspersion against women or a put down against women, but definitely something that is good to understand the context of that. I really like the way you place the soul in the body. I think of the soul as the driver and the body as a vehicle. And that maybe kind of relates to Phaedrus, you know, that lovely discussion about the charioteer. And there's a white horse and a dark horse. And the soul is the driver of those horses. It's not the body that's driving, it's the soul. That thing inside us, that spirit, that impulse inside us that's doing that part of us that operates with reason, which is not a physical part of us. It's not the physical part of us that operates with reason. It's the part of us that can reach into that realm of being that operates with reason. And that's the driver. The body does what the driver wants it to do. So this is why I think it's very important that the soul is placed first, the body is second. The soul needs the body. I mean, the soul can't really accomplish much without a body, but the body will dissipate very quickly if the soul drives it poorly. And that's, I think, the great thing about Phaedrus, the charioteer analogy. I really like the way to talk about a relevance to modern times where we live in an incredibly materialist world. As you mentioned, money has no intrinsic value, and yet we seek material things and we don't tend to think of the immaterial, the soul, as being more valuable than the material. And this is, I think, a very important issue of our time. And when he says that the search for excessive wealth, excessive pleasure, excessive liberty, I think is something that is really leading a lot of people in the world astray now, and a lot of leaders in the world astray. When the word liberty is used now, for example, a lot of people think that it means that they should be subject to no rules, no external rules. And we saw this, I think, during the COVID pandemic that was unleashed in 2020, where a lot of people felt that they had no responsibility to their community to prevent the spread of an infection. And so their sense of liberty was that they could go out and infect other people. If that was the case, so be it. Whereas a number of us thought, well, maybe there is a point that, you know, our liberty needs to give way to a greater good. And I think it really came into stark focus during the COVID period when we were asked to be in lockdown, asked to especially be conscious of the older people and people with health issues who are especially susceptible to this virus. And many, many people perished. And a lot of people valued their what they thought was liberty, but was actually very dangerous and very damaging, I think, to society. I don't know, what's your take on the question of liberty here? Servitude in excess and liberty in excess are very great evils.
Well, that might be the perfect summation of one of Plato's great theses, that the opposite of tyranny is not absolute liberty. The opposite of tyranny is justice, which is the golden mean between them. So he emphasizes very clearly here that slavery is an evil. So I just want to again correct the record. Plato was not a totalitarian. He hated slavery. He hated subjugation. He wanted to free societies from this. But the reason he gets misread as a totalitarian by some readers is because he also sees the kind of freedom that the Democrats in ancient Sicily were advocating for as an evil as well. And we might call the thesis here libertarianism. That might be how we encounter it today. This kind of idea that the worst possible thing is for me to have to live under a government and a set of laws, because those are going to impede my ability to do what I want. So when he uses the word compromise here, that we're looking for a compromise between them, that word doesn't translate well today. We think of compromises as, well, nobody wins, everybody gets a little bit of what they want, and it's just about the competition of interests. But as he makes clear here, he brings up the language of due measure, which comes from the statesman dialogue. And he says, this is why both servitude in excess and liberty in excess are very great evils, but in due measure, both are great goods. Now, the due measure, that is justice, is that the just society is one where we are serving our neighbor. So we're taking responsibility for each other, but we're free in the sense that nobody is living for the benefit of somebody else and not for their own benefit. Because when we're taking responsibility for each other, we're also taking responsibility for ourselves. And that's how Plato conceives of the common good. I live my life in a way that benefits you, and in so doing, that benefits my life too. And you're doing the exact same. So that's what he means by saying, in due measure, servitude and liberty are great goods, because you can't have a just society without people serving each other, and you can't have a just society if some people are subjugating others.
Absolutely. And to recall the Republic again, he was very clear that none of us can live a life completely alone. We all depend on each other for something. I think I might have mentioned before, I can't build houses. I depend on somebody to put four walls and a roof above my head. I can't make clothing. I need somebody to do that. I can't make food. I need somebody to get the food into the grocery store so that I can eat. So we are all dependent on other people to some degree. We made the point actually when we discussed the laws, and I think you made the point very clearly then about education and the idea that if we allow others to educate us, they'll indoctrinate us. Well, we all are educated somehow, and if it's not some sort of coordinated education that is geared towards virtue, we fall prey to others who educate us in a certain way that maybe makes us think that we're free, think that we're free agents, but we wind up spouting what they say. We fall under their influence. And I think we see a lot of legislators now who have become subjected to this, who think that they are free and at liberty, but they are really just have become beholden to these other interests. So is true absolute free liberty, libertarianism, is that possible? Or does that really become some sort of slavishness?
Yeah, that's such a great point, that absolute freedom is not real freedom. And just as he thinks absolute tyranny is not real happiness. That was one of the points in here, that the tyrant, the foolish saying of w women and children, the idiom, what it was referring to is this maxim that those who have great power or those who have great wealth are the most happy. And that's not true either. So he's rejecting both of these fictions that orient unjust societies. And then at the end of the passage you read, where he's still speaking in the putative voice of Dion, he then gives a very practical policy recommendation. What should you do? He says, the Democrats and the advocates for the restoration of the tyranny should come to the table and, in a sense, both give up their ambitions, but in exchange, they'll get what they truly want, not what they think they want, but what they truly want. The people who want the restoration of the tyranny, they'll get their office. The office of the ruler will be restored, but as a responsible kingship, not as a tyranny. So they're not really getting what they want, but they're getting something better. And the Democrats are going to get the freedom they desire, but it's not the freedom to do whatever you want, it's the freedom to live under a just ruler. Okay, because that for Plato is true freedom. And just in case this is unclear to anybody, he ends with that last clause that says, in a responsible kingship, you have laws punishing kings and citizens alike if they disobey. Now, Western democracies today think that's some kind of modern invention. We see no, that's a very old idea. And it's something that we're struggling with today. I won't get into the details, but in my country, it's become painfully clear that there are and have been for a long time at least two sets of laws. There's the laws that apply to me as a relative nobody in my society, and then there's the laws that apply to the rich and powerful, where if you have enough money or have enough of a legal team on retainer, you can get around the law. And that's precisely the kind of problem that Plato is trying to address. He's saying, Sicilians, you can have justice in your society if Democrats give up absolute freedom and the people advocating for the restoration of the tyranny give up absolute tyranny. Both of you will end up with something far better. That's the real accomplishment of your aims.
Yeah, well said. And yeah, the key is that the king has to be responsible as well. The king is a subject of the laws as much as the people are. It's hard to, I'm just, trying to think of, historically such king-like people. It's hard to come up with one that has subjected themselves to the laws in such a way, but it's not that it's not impossible. And we'll see in the next section actually where he discusses a way that kings can be kind of taken out of some of this temptation of especially bloodshed, I think is the key thing in the next section, which I mislabeled in the notes. It's 355A to 355E. But this continues on with the idea of the responsible king. So maybe if you would mind reading that, Michael.
So we're continuing in the voice of Dion, which again, we don't really know if Dion necessarily said these things. My guess is what Plato's reconstructing for us is the things that he and Dion talked about and advocated for. And so Plato is saying that he feels very comfortable speaking on Dion's behalf about these things. Now, with a steadfast and wholehearted adherence to all these conditions, and with God's help, appoint three kings. First, my son, in double gratitude for my father's services and my own, as my father in his time saved the city from the barbarians, I have twice freed it from tyrants, as you yourselves can bear witness. Secondly, him who has the same name as my father and is the son of Dionysius. In gratitude with the help he has just rendered your cause, as well as because of his upright character, for though he is the son of a tyrant, he is voluntarily liberating the city and gaining for himself and his house undying honor in place of an ephemeral and unjust tyranny. Thirdly, invite him who is now head of the army of your enemies, Dionysius, the son of Dionysius, to become king of the Syracusans as willing king of a willing city. If, through fear of misfortune and pity for his native city and its neglected temples and tombs, he shows himself willing to exchange his power for that of a king, in order that his city may not be completely ruined by this civil strife and fall a rich prize to the barbarians. Let these then be your kings, three in number. Whether you invest them with the authority of the Spartan kings or agree upon some more limited powers for them, install them in something like the following manner. I have already said this to you on a former occasion, but it is well that you hear it again. If the family of Dionysius and Hipparnius is willing to end the present disorders for the salvation of Sicily and gain enduring honors for themselves and their houses on these terms, then, as I have said, summon ambassadors with full authority to effect a reconciliation. Let these ambassadors be whoever and as many as they please, chosen from persons here or abroad or both. When they have come together, let them begin by drawing up laws and a constitution providing that the king shall have authority over religions and all other matters appropriate to former benefactors of the city, but that matters of war and peace shall be under the control of 35 guardians of the laws, ruling in conjunction with the assembly and council. There should be various courts of justice for various offenses. But offenses involving death or exile should be judged by the 35 in conjunction with other select judges chosen each year from the office holders of the preceding year, one from each office, namely that officer who showed himself the best and justest. These should, for the ensuing year, judge all cases involving the death or imprisonment or exiling of citizens. But a king should not be permitted to act as judge in such cases, since, like a priest, he is to remain undefiled by bloodshed or imprisonment or exile.
Yeah, again, it's hard to think of a historical precedent for such a person, but I think he mentions the word willing several times in here, that the city should be willing, but that the ruler should be willing to exchange power for that of a king. So I think this willingness is key, and to avoid civil strife, which we are seeing lots of civil strife these days in countries that call themselves democracies, whether they practice democracy or not, but civil strife is on the rise. So it's this question of willingness, both of the ruled and the ruler, I think is key. And here again, he calls for guardians of the laws, as he did in the laws, which we spoke about at length. And it's the idea that there are these people whose job it is to ensure that the laws apply to everybody and not just the citizens, but also to the rulers. And I think this is a really kind of unique idea. I don't know if it's ever been practiced, but it's a really unique idea. And it kind of reminds me too of what he said, what Plato said in The Statesman, that the day-to-day operation of government could be under elected people, functionaries, but that the overall ruling should be the one that determines what time is best to implement certain things, as opposed to the functionaries, the people in charge of the government will want something specific to happen, maybe to benefit them in a particular time. You would have this overall ruler who wouldn't be charged with running the operations of government, but would say, no, now's not the time to go to war, or now's not the time to run a huge deficit, or now's not the time to do some of these things, right? It's kind of like with that long-term view, which is lacking, I think, in modern governments, as we spoke of before.
Yeah, absolutely. Some high-level comments about this passage. First of all, it'd be hard to know what's going on here if you haven't studied the laws. So that's why it's really good that we're looking at these letters after our careful study of the laws, because we understand this very much is the voice of Plato offering up two things: separation of powers and checks and balances. So I argued in our laws discussions that Plato is really one of the originators of these ideas. There is a little bit of precursor to these ideas in Solon the lawgiver, who was sort of the first great reformer of Athens, and Plato is a descendant of Solon. But Plato has really expanded this idea. So here in this compromise, he's offering the Democrats and the supporters of the tyranny, we're going to get not one king, but three, right? And the three kings are supposed to bring together the three factions. And as you said, they're supposed to be willing kings of a willing city. That is, there's a sense in which the kings are going to be servants of the city, and the city will be servants of the king. So they're going to be collaborators here. And I just want to highlight before we get into any of the weeds, the really practical context for why Plato is making this recommendation. Because you might think, maybe you think this is bad advice, that we shouldn't have this trifold monarchy leading the city. Well, the reason why he's looking for this alliance between the different factions is because he says, in order that the city may not be completely ruined by this civil strife and fall a rich prize to the barbarians. This is something that's really evident in Book 5 of the Republic and in certain sections of the laws, where Plato is always writing for how to build a just city, but he's aware that cities exist within a context, that there are other cities and nations out there. And in particular, he's worried about colonial empires that are always looking to expand their collection of vassal states. And so he's saying, look, the Carthaginians are out there. And if they detect a sufficient level of internal weakness in the city, they're going to come and enslave you all. So we don't have time to sit around for 50 years and, try to work this out and see, which of us really should rule and all this stuff. We've got to find a practical way to bring justice to bear on the city now so that the civil strife can stop, because that's good for the city, but it's also good for creating a city-state strong enough to make the barbarians take a second thought and say, ah, they're not worth the effort. They're too strong for us to try to take over.
And I wanted to ask you what Plato means by barbarians, because this comes up several times, I think, in a number of dialogues. It's not necessarily what we think of barbarians now. But before I do that, I just wanted to highlight what you said about separations of power and checks and balances, where we have modern constitutions that do attempt to separate power and did attempt to incorporate checks and balances, but we see now where factionalism and the fact that people and parties are able to override these checks and balances really kind of makes a mockery of this whole idea. And I think when these constitutions were written, and this again is why in both the Laws and the Statesman, Plato warns against adhering to ancient constitutions without updating them and understanding what changes have gone on. So, maybe when somebody drafted a constitution 250 years ago, it was assumed that there would be some virtue in the elected people and that they would have some exercise of self-restraint. But I think when the political system becomes so tribal, so power-oriented, that people can run roughshod over that. And that's where I think it's key to revisit these constitutions and constantly look at them and just kind of look at what changes have gone on in society and look at, again, ideas like this very kind of unique idea, guardians of the laws, separate kingships, working with elected people. It's not that we have to give ourselves into some sort of, it's not that we have to abandon liberty and freedom. It's just a different way of doing things to protect liberty and freedom in the end.
Yeah, there are no suggestions for policies from Plato in his letters or in his dialogues that are divorced from his admonition that only the virtuous should rule. He opens the Republic by saying the only people who should hold power are those who don't want it. That's his shorthand for virtuous people, because it's only virtuous people who don't want power. And the reason they don't want it is they know that virtue is more valuable than power over their neighbor. So, yes, checks and balances and separations of power, these will only work if the occupants in those separate spheres of power and who are adjudicating those checks and balances are people of reasonable character. It doesn't have to be the most virtuous people. That might be a too stringent of a standard, but they need to be people who pass a minimal conception of virtue, Plato thinks. And I think what you're alluding to is that Western societies have been really tightly wed to systems of elections, where the goal of an election is to win a popularity contest. And whenever you start selecting your leaders through who can become the most popular with the masses, you're really diverging that selection process away from selecting leaders who are the most virtuous. Because in order to become popular, you have to be willing to say anything, to lie, cheat, and steal to make people believe what you want them to believe. And so it kind of sets leaders up to compromise their virtue internally. Let me quickly speak to your question about barbarians. So, in case listeners want to go and do a little research, The Statesman has a really great discussion where he lays out the Platonic way to understand this term. I don't know if this was common amongst all Greeks or if this is an innovation of Plato's, but barbarian is not an aspersion. So he's not talking about uncivilized people or savages or anything like that. That is how we tend to use the word today. And it became a pejorative over time because it was generally applied to imperial nations looking to subjugate people. So obviously that has a negative valence to it. But Plato's very clear in The Statesman that a barbarian is a catch-all term for essentially non-Greeks. And what it really means is a non-ethnically unified people who are outside of the Greek culture that are trying to assimilate and annihilate the Greek culture. This is something that he worries about a lot because Athens was often vulnerable to takeover by nearby empires. And one of the ways that he characterizes that is that these empires, because they absorb so many peoples and cultures and whatnot into them, that they're not unified by a common language, a common history, a common religion, or anything like that. And so they are barbarians. That is, they're a pastiche of different things. They're not a one thing. And so a barbarian is just a non-Greek that is an amalgamation of all of these things rather than a unified culture.
And such a barbarian would come in, and barbarian with military might would come in and impose their way of life on the Greeks, which is maybe there are some things that the Greeks could learn from other ways of life, but to have it imposed, I guess, is the key thing that is to be avoided here.
And more than imposed, the practice of imperial powers in that day, and this is something that's continued for a long time, and we even see a little bit today, is to ethnically cleanse the people. And what that meant typically was you would enslave a large portion of the population and transplant them somewhere else. Somewhere where nobody spoke the language and they'd be forced to learn a different language. Oftentimes, temples would be desecrated, they would be raided for their valuables, and whatever local religions were practiced would be banned. So, what they're trying to do is destroy your sense of self. And the reason they did that is if you don't have a unified sense of self, it's hard for you to organize a resistance. And so Plato is really prescient here. He's recognizing that the way for these little Mediterranean city-states to resist imperial takeover is to recognize that they have a common history, they have a common culture, they have a common language, and that makes it easier for them to organize a confederacy that can stand up to the empire.
It may be a lesson for the empire builders out there today that, and what you said about popularity, I've said many times technology or modern technology leads to that so-called social media, which isn't really social. It's all about getting likes, it's about getting exposure. Political ideas or ideas themselves are reduced to 2-minute sound bites. Everybody's chasing after the like button. Everybody wants to be reposted through people's networks. And these are riddled with so-called influencers that make money by putting out these memes. And it really becomes a contest, not elections are not a contest of ideas anymore. And I mentioned this, my own province of Ontario went through an election a few weeks back, and was there discussion about ideas? No, it was very little discussion about ideas. So this is what I think a lot of people would like to see in elections, but good people don't want to get involved in politics. Now, as you said, the ideal of Plato would be that the people who don't want to be involved are made to be involved. But good people, I think, now would run the other way because the abuse that they're subjected to and their inability to get ideas across unless they are particularly telegenic. Unless they are able to manipulate media in a way to get their ideas across in the way that people used to these 2-minute sound bites would understand, it just becomes impossible. So technology has made that very, very difficult. But I think, as you said before, it really stuck in my mind. I think it was our first episode on Letter Seven, was really, this is maybe coming down to a Plato saying, love your neighbor, work with your neighbor. As I reflect on letters six, seven, and eight, that keeps coming through. I think that's the overarching theme, and it's a very, I think, empowering theme. But it's one that means that we have to give up some of the pursuit of self-benefit, self-aggrandizement, to understand that in the long term, it's better to work with our neighbors than it is to work against them.
Yeah, absolutely. In particular, I think it's going to require us to give up the right to an opinion, because what this has morphed into is I can go onto social media and say the most uninformed, illiterate, bigoted thing that I want. And if anybody challenges me on it, I could say, well, I have a right to my opinion. That's the kind of freedom that Plato thinks will destroy a society. If you can have an opinion about a vaccine's effectiveness, if you can have an opinion about who's at fault in a wartime situation, if you can have an opinion about the best way to manage currencies through international markets, and you know nothing about these, then we will not have a politics governed by knowledge. So that's an example of the kind of self-aggrandizement in the practical sense we'd have to give up, because social media is all about preening and impressing people, or owning people, or mocking people or whatever, and we're doing it with uninformed opinions. That's the kind of thing we have to expunge from political discourse in order to be free, that is, to be governed by reason, by knowledge. And the only thing I want to add to your wonderful comment about loving our neighbor is I think the thread that we've really seen through both letter six and letter eight in this discussion is Plato is saying, everybody love your neighbor and king most of all. In other words, there is a heightened responsibility for the rulers to love their neighbor. And so, yes, there's a sense in which we're talking about an equal society, but the king is lower in rank. That's really the way to think about Plato, that and what he means by that is the responsibility on the king is so much greater than it is just on an ordinary baker. And they're loving their neighbor. They still have to love their neighbor, but it's not quite the same degree. So I think part of the problem in our modern society is we've really become people who cut presidents and prime ministers and other parliamentary leaders more slack than we should cut them. And what we actually need to get around to is being much more skeptical of their power, making it clear to them that when they take office, we're going to demand a lot from you. And if you're not ready for that kind of pressure, don't take this office, because we're going to put more pressure on you than the ordinary person has to love their neighbor.
Well said. And I think too, the good leaders deserve some respect, and that respect has been lost. I think now where simply people just say a pox on all of you, it just you're all terrible. It just becomes a race to the bottom, as opposed to if a good leader actually did rise up and respected the laws and took that burden of responsibility seriously, some respect is due to that leader because it's a tough job. Not that I know, but I can imagine it's a very tough job. And I think we've seen some leaders who have done some things with a great deal of responsibility over history. But what I really like what you said about opinion, because that recalls the divided line of knowledge in Plato's Republic. And what people call opinions now are not opinions. Well, in a lot of cases, in the divided line of knowledge, belief is the lowest level, and that's unsupported by facts. It's just pure belief. Opinion is the second level, not the first, but not the fourth, which is the highest level. Opinion is the second level, and there should be some basis for opinion. And so when anybody spouts any ideas now and they say, well, it's my opinion and I have a right to it, no, you don't, as you said. You can support your opinion, and then it deserves to be called an opinion. And then you can talk about what supports your opinion. You just can't say vaccines are dangerous. Show us the proof. Show us the evidence for that, and then engage in a reasoned discussion with other people who have different opinions to come out to the third level of the divided line of knowledge, which is knowledge. And then finally, maybe some wisdom will come out of that, which is the fourth level of the divided line of knowledge. So, yeah, I think we misuse this word opinion now. We've had a really great discussion on three of Plato's letters, and I see his voice in all of these three. I really don't doubt that these are Plato's words. I think it's really, as you remarked before, it's really interesting and unique how Plato described his life, gave us this biographical context, and shows us in these letters how a philosopher can bring that realm of ideas down from that realm of being using reason and the mind and operationalize it in the realm of becoming. And you can do so successfully sometimes, and that's maybe the hope of letter six, is hopefully that the three of them will work together successfully. And then there will be failure sometimes. And he acknowledges his failure with Dionysius in the seventh letter, but he had some success with Dion. Dion paid the price that Socrates paid of being assassinated, but Dion's memory is more valuable, I think, than the legacy of Dionysius. And that's maybe what I'm reading from this. I'm thinking that soul of Dion is out there and nourishes us still, whereas the soul of Dionysus was a very confused soul, and that's not the kind of mind that we would want to find ourselves in. Any sort of overall thoughts about the three letters?
Well, I'm once again struck by both the humility of Plato, his integrity, his willingness to be sober-minded about what has worked and what hasn't, and the realities of the on-the-ground situation. And yet, I always come back in these discussions with you, James, to his optimism that Plato absolutely believes history matters and we should learn from it, we should study it, we should apply it. But he does not believe the future is determined by the past, that we always have the option to do the impossible, to demand the impossible, to change our imagination on what we think is possible. And I would hope that readers of Plato today would be inspired to look at what has worked over the last few hundred years of the societies we find ourselves in and what has not, and learn from that and start to ask ourselves, okay, what have we taken off the table about how we could fix and improve our societies that we should start putting back on the table that we thought was impossible, but now recognizing the limitations of our current societies, let's imagine, let's dream a little bit and see what ideals might be waiting for us that we didn't realize were possible. And if we would just put them into practice, we could get a little bit closer to the form of justice.
That was beautiful. Yeah, the future is not determined by the past, and change the imagination. And especially now with the power of technology, there's so much good that we can do with technology. We have this incredible power. And instead of using it to destroy things, which may have been the method of the past, let's not look back to the greatness is not in the past, it's in the future. And this is, I think, the key thing to the human spirit is this ability to have imagination. And we can't let our imaginations be constrained by looking at images on a screen or images on a wall and thinking that the reality is what we make it, and we have this ability, and we just simply can't be trapped into thinking that what was is the greatest and that we'll never get greater than that. So yeah, thank you. Very, very beautifully said. The future is not determined by the past. Well, it's been so great talking about these letters. As I said at the beginning, I really appreciate your suggesting them because I had not read these letters before, but it really does put a very fresh and very, to say, hopeful tone to Plato. And I think we've managed to bring in many of his dialogues into this. He's clearly very consistent, I think, in what he says, and consistent in his practice in these letters to tie back to what he's said in his dialogues. And I think he does present us with that sense of hope that we can find a path. So I think that's a great part of these letters. So I really appreciate it.
Thank you, James. I've really enjoyed this as well.
Well, we'll look forward to our next discussion where we will advance to Neoplatonists and look at modern interpretations of Plato. So I'm looking forward to that. So thanks again, and we look forward to talking to you again soon.